Welcome to the Oh Wow Science Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by the UIF Adult Education Program at the Unalaska Learning Center. At UIF, we honor and recognize that we are on Indigenous Onangam Tenangin land where this podcast is being recorded. My name is Tatiana, and my goal is to bring you fun science facts and ideas every Friday at noon and Saturday at 4 p.m. on KUCB. Episode 8, Molecules and Other Tiny Biologies. Hello, thank you for stopping by the UAF podcast where I bring you science facts every week. And just a reminder, if you missed any of my previous episodes, you can always go on kucb.org and under programs find the Oh Wow Science podcast where you can replay every episode that's come out so far. And every week I have a new science topic, so you might find something that you like, even if not everything about science is interesting to you. I try to bring diversity to what I talk about because I want to make sure it's not just me and the things I find interesting. And it also challenges me to learn about those other topics in science that I haven't looked into that much until I have to make an episode about it for Oh Wow Science. I also want to remind you all out there that the Unalaska Learning Center is here to meet your educational needs, whatever they may be. Whether it's taking an art class, learning a new skill, or continuing your education by getting some college credits, we offer all of that. We also offer you the opportunity to get your GED or other job-related skills like practice in reading, writing, resume skills. So if you need to build a resume, if you need help with all of that, we have many resources. We have books and computers for test taking, and we will help get you where you need to be. So please contact us if you have specific questions about what we offer and how we can help you. Our number is 907-581-1876. On to today's episode, however, I thought we should explore the microscopic in this life because everything is made up of the tiny molecules that we can't see. We ourselves are made up of the basic building blocks of all living things, which are cells. Let's start with the first interesting question that is relevant to all of us, which is how many cells make up our body? Cells are these tiny things that we can only see through a microscope, and we have around 30 trillion cells that make up our bodies, and 1 million of those cells die every second. Yes, every second. Your body is always changing and rebuilding and healing and growing. It's always fixing itself and multiplying its cells and then killing the bad cells and so on. So about every 7 years that you're alive, you've replaced every cell in your body by that point, which is both awesome and scary, but think of it as an opportunity to become who you want to be. Think about how every second you're alive, you can create the change in yourself on a cellular level. Whether it's by changing your diet or your exercise or your mindset, it all affects us on a cellular level. We are our physical bodies, basically. Like when you work out, a bunch of muscle cells are broken, actually, which is why you're sore the next day. And then those cells are replaced by stronger muscle cells, which is why it's good to work out. So if you keep working out, then 7 years later, you'll be a completely different person. But honestly, no, it doesn't take that long to see the effects of exercise because your body is not only muscle cells, so it's all kinds of cells that make up our body. So let's talk about cell types and cell evolution because, like I said, every living thing has cells, not just as humans, but trees and grasses have plant cells, which are different from animal cells. And then there's bacteria, which have different and simpler cells than we do because they're a lot smaller. And there's just less going on in smaller organisms. But speaking of bacteria, did you know there's more bacteria cells living in and on you than there are cells that make up your body? That's mostly because your gut has so many bacteria. It's like a symbiotic relationship most of the time, at least, where the bacteria help you break down the fiber that you eat in your food and give you those nutrients. And they also benefit by getting to eat that fiber. So it's a win-win unless you have some bad guys in there, which we all do, but hopefully not as many as the good guys. And it also depends on what kind of bad guys, of course. Some bacteria make you sick, like if you have a cold. And some bacteria just want you to eat sugar and ice cream. So you see, like, it's all relative. Bad guys are relative too. But bacteria is so fascinating, actually, and they're so ancient, meaning that these simple forms were the first to evolve on Earth. Meaning, like, the first sign of life was bacteria on Earth. And then later on, the Earth's evolution, more complex life forms evolved, like the animal and plant cells that we have now. So to speak about the origins of life on Earth, we have to talk about cells because it is thought that cells were the first form of the evolution of life on this planet. Right now, the theory is that this first cell evolved on planet Earth around 3.5 billion years ago. That is a long time ago. And the Earth itself is only about 4.5 billion years old. So that means for about a billion years, there was no life on the planet, or no cellular life as we think of life now, which is made up of cells. So maybe there were a bunch of atoms and reactions happening all over the place, but they weren't being formed into cellular life or any kind of, you know, organism or creature like we have now on Earth. And the thing that made these cells into cells was a couple of things. Like how did nothing become something, right? Like how did these cells evolve? Well, number one was the fact that they had a covering called a membrane. So out of nothing appeared a membrane. And this is one of the necessary parts of being a cell. And number two, the fact that the cell had genetic material. So these are two things that cells needed to form, to become cells, basically to form life, to be categorized as the first life on Earth. And so the genetic material inside is what makes these cells unique to an extent. And it's what made them who they were when they first appeared on Earth. And by genetic material, I mean like the DNA that we have. Although at the time, 3.5 billion years ago, it probably evolved first as RNA, which is a lot smaller. It's like half of DNA. It's like one of the DNA strands. And I'll talk about that later. So this is the stuff that cells can pass down when they replicate or multiply the DNA. This is how they multiply. And the cell membrane, that second part, keeps all of that genetic material safe and away from the elements. Like it's a covering, literally, that's on the outside, and it basically differentiates the inside versus the outside of a cell. So think about, you know, before the first cell, think about there was nothing like this, and you know, and out of nothing, out of atoms, out of that crazy chaotic time on Earth, the very early stages of Earth as a planet, now we have life because now we have these tiny, tiny microscopic things that we can't see with our naked eye suddenly have a membrane, and suddenly they have, you know, genetic material inside, and they say, oh, this is who I am, basically. And the reason we know the time around when this happened is because these microscopic cells left evidence of their life on some rocks, and then some paleontologists found these very old rocks recently. So this very first cell, the very first ancestor to all of life, is a very simple cell. This is a tiny, simple cell, and over time, this cell was able to evolve and change into several kinds. And then also, it was able to combine with other cells to form organisms, like us humans. But in general, you know, a lot of stuff happened between 3.5 billion years ago and now. And today, after all that, we have two categories of cells now. Number one, there's the eukaryotic cell. So this kind of cell, it has a nucleus. And a nucleus is a little room inside of the cell, or a little space that's closed off. And it's like a vault for the DNA to be kept inside, to be kept safe and not be able to be changed or affected by things going on the outside of it, because, you know, DNA is crucial to life, and that's the cell's genetic material. That's what makes the cell who it is. So it has the nucleus to keep it safe from all of the outside. And the big eukaryotic cells have this nucleus, right? And in this category, the eukaryotic category, we have the animal cells, which is us, our human cells and other animals. And then there's the plant cells, which is trees and everything green. Those have plant cells. Plant cells and animal cells are a little bit different. Well, for one, plant cells have photosynthesis, which means they make food out of sunlight, and that's not something we animals can do, obviously. You know, we need to eat food to get our energy. So plant cells are special. And another thing that's different is they have a cell wall. The plant's cell wall is the thing that keeps plant upright because of its stiffness. So if you're touching a blade of grass, you're actually touching the outside of the cell wall of the grass cell. Isn't that cool? Plant cells also rely a lot on water to keep their shape because they fill up with water. So if you're wondering why your house plant is wilting, it's because you're not watering it enough. And the water literally drains out and makes the cells all droopy, and so the plant will fall over. But animal cells like ours, we've got the soft tissue version of cells. So our cells are mostly on the inside of our bodies, right? And we don't need walls to keep ourselves standing up, so to speak, like blades of grass or leaves. Anyway, moving on. So the second category of cells that we have on Earth is prokaryotic cells. These cells don't have a nucleus. And these cells are simpler and smaller and just less complex in general if you compare the two types of cells. The prokaryotic cells are the bacteria cells that we still have around. So any bacteria you can think of is going to be prokaryotic. And they have DNA, of course, they have to have DNA, but it's just kind of floating around on the inside without any designated area. I mean, it's kind of in the middle, but it's just, you know, it doesn't have a nucleus. It's just kind of floating there. And some prokaryotic cells even have a little tail that lets them move around the space, whatever space they're in, since a lot of these cells are individualistic rather than part of a bigger creature, like our cells are part of us and we're the bigger creature. And actually, prokaryotic organisms are all single-celled. So you know, when I say prokaryotic cells, you can think, oh, that's, you know, they're their own organism. They're all single-celled. So they're just out there roaming around as their own little creatures rather than making big creatures like plants or animals. So that's the other difference between the two types of cells. The eukaryotic cells, which are complex and are trying to, you know, gather together to and have evolved to make bigger organisms. And then prokaryotics are individualistic. But actually, there are eukaryotic single-celled organisms too out there. And that's what I mean. By that, I mean it's a single cell that is an organism all on its own. And, you know, we all have, of course, we all have all kinds of diversity in this world. And the rule of thumb that I've learned about nature is that everything will have an exception and nothing is 100% true in every circumstance, except maybe in math or physics. But as we saw in a previous episode, even physics is finding its exceptions to the theories that they have in this world. But one example of this eukaryotic single-celled organism is yeast. So the kind that you use in cooking. That's a eukaryotic cell that's also just a single organism. You know, it's all by itself, so it's tiny. And another example is us. Well, at the very beginning, at least, like at the very moment of conception, we are only one cell. Until that cell multiplies and forms body parts and everything in our body. So technically, we come from one eukaryotic cell, but don't stay one cell. Like I said, we become 30 trillion cells. And before I move on from bacteria into other microscopic things, I need to share with you this recent article that came out with the following title. Scientists pull living microbes, possibly 100 million years old, from beneath the sea. So that's the title. And I'm bringing up this study because it's like an example of how awesome bacteria are. And in this study, scientists drilled into the deadest part of the ocean as they know it, which is like South Pacific, and tried to investigate whether there was anything living there. Now, imagine this. We already don't have many things living on the ocean floor. And I'm not talking about the surface of the water, but I'm talking about the surface of the floor of the ocean, where the earth is. Basically under the ocean. And the reason not many things live so far down below, basically nothing does, is because there is no sunlight that reaches that far down, because the depth of water obscures it, and all creatures need sunlight and oxygen to survive, or at least we thought so. But bacteria have proven time and time again to be so resilient. Bacteria can do everything from eat plastics to living in space. Yes, bacteria has been even found living on the outside of the International Space Station for years, which means they're living in space, in the cold and dark that is space without oxygen. So in this ocean study, the scientists drilled into the bottom of the ocean core, down to where there's nothing that could sustain life, and found bacteria that happened to be so old as to be 100 million years old or so. And they took this bacteria into the lab and gave them food. And guess what? These bacteria started to multiply like they were alive again, which means they were alive, as science would tell us. What does this mean, though? It means that bacteria can survive in a probably dormant state where they're just waiting for the right conditions to wake up again, kind of like hibernating. Even at the lowest amount of oxygen and light found anywhere on Earth. It also means that life does not stop. This may be a trick that bacteria evolved in order to survive the early conditions of the Earth, where there was nothing but a bunch of volcanoes and lots of change is that we're not nice to be living in, like not comfy. Like we as humans, by the way, are generally very sensitive to environmental conditions because we have so many internal microbiological processes to keep up nonstop in order to live. Like there's so much going on inside your body right now. And for example, without technology, we require like around a 60 to 70 Fahrenheit degree climate if we don't have homes or warm clothes in order to survive. And oh, we need oxygen and sunlight and a diverse diet and some amino acids that we can only get from food that our bodies can't produce on their own, among many other things that we need to survive, like friendship and partners to successfully reproduce. Yeah, we're super high maintenance compared to bacteria. Or maybe the word should be complex, since bacteria is not very complex, and we are. Let's zoom in now, microbiologically or molecularly, and look even further into ourselves, and let's look at the world of DNA, or the genetic information that we all carry inside of us, and that has coded for everything that we are as individuals. So first of all living things contain DNA. It's the one thing that makes us living. If you have DNA, you're alive. If you don't have DNA, like if you're a rock, then you're not alive. Another thing about DNA, or our genetic information, is that we are 99.9% the same between each other, and only 0.1% of our DNA differs between each person, and that's probably rounded up. So what is DNA? DNA is four units of code that are combined in different combinations on a linear strand of DNA. But the shape of DNA is interesting because it's what's called a double helix. It's basically two strands that run alongside each other in parallel directions and twist together at the same time. So imagine a ladder, and the side rails of the ladder are the DNA strands. And you take that ladder and pretend that you can twist it a little bit, like circularly. So that's what DNA is. It's like a twisted ladder. It is a ladder of information with a bunch of code, almost like computer code. And you or me or us, we have a ton of DNA each. One DNA strand from one cell can stretch up to 6 feet long. And that's something so small that we can't see it with our naked eye. And if you stretch all the DNA from each cell in your body end to end, it would reach from the earth to the sun and back 300 times. It would still be invisible though, because like I said, it's so small we can't see it with our naked eyes. So these four units of code, they're called bases. The four units that make up DNA. And they're abbreviated into A, T, C, or G bases. These are the combinations that code for how our body looks like, how it behaves, feels, smells, everything from our brain cells to our eye color to our immune system, and what kind of foods we like to eat. This code makes up our genes. So each gene could have a bunch of bases or only a couple, it depends on the gene. And a gene usually corresponds to a specific trait in our body. These are the blueprints for who we are. These is what genes are, is our blueprints, right? So there is a gene for what kind of hair texture you have. Is it straight or is it wavy? There is a different gene for the color of your hair, or there is a gene for whether you're right-handed or left-handed. So they're kind of specific things that in the end make you who you are. But genes aren't always expressed. So this is a combination of genetic predisposition and actual expression of a gene. This debate is called nature versus nurture, right? So like, what are you born with and what are things that you develop or learn? And basically the starting question of any geneticist or molecular biologist is to ask if this behavior is something found in genes or something that the person learned maybe when they were very young, or even both, because it's mostly both. It's mostly a combination of how you were raised in a specific environment and what genes you have available to succeed in that environment. And who knows, maybe you have several genes for something, but only one of them is chosen to be expressed based on what you needed to survive in an environment. For example, you can be predisposed to have a certain disease or to have freckles. But if your lifestyle doesn't do anything to allow that gene to be expressed, like if you don't go outside in the sun ever, you won't get freckles because they're a reaction to the sun. Or if you're able to live a certain way that doesn't let your body develop that disease, then you won't develop that disease. Some people say that diet and exercise can help put off certain diseases if you've never heard of that before. But genetics is tricky. It's tricky to know how our genes are being expressed and whether what we do is because of our genes or because of a learned behavior. So a lot of what geneticists do in their work is study genes. That's what they do because they're so important to how we live, how we get sick, and even how we can heal. So knowing our genes has become very important to humans and scientists and medical doctors, which is why in the 90s, a massive project called the Human Genome Project was approved. This project wanted to unravel and translate every single code on our human DNA. Those four letters that I mentioned that line the strands of DNA. And this is a crazy proposition because there are over 3 billion bases in our DNA. And scientists were going to write down every single one and then try to understand which genes go where. And this took over 10 years. It was an international project. But finally in 2003, it was completed. And now geneticists are able to use that information to study every single gene that might be found in our DNA. It was an exciting time and it revealed a lot of interesting stuff about us. For example, it revealed that only 2% of that whole DNA strand even does anything in terms of coding for stuff, you know, like genes or proteins and stuff. So 98% of our DNA doesn't seem to have a function that we know of, meaning it doesn't code for genes or proteins, like I said. So why is it there? What is it doing? And this is what, at the time, scientists decided to call, quote, junk DNA, literally, like it does nothing. So if you pick up a biology textbook from 10 years ago, which is when I was in school, scientists said, this is called junk DNA. You know, it's just meaningless. It's extra, or it's left over from previous evolutionary times, maybe. But in the last 10 years, more and more scientists are trying to understand if maybe we're just not smart enough to know what those parts are useful for yet. Maybe they don't code for specific genes, but are they there for some other purpose? Some theories are that this DNA is regulatory. It's actually regulating those other gene parts to make sure they're accurate in some shape or form that we have yet to understand. And who knows, there might be undiscovered mysteries still left in the microscopic corners of our DNA. How about we zoom in even more into the molecular world and cross over to the field of chemistry rather than just biology? And in zooming in, we're going to encounter the smallest unit of matter on Earth, which is an atom. So let's compare the size of a cell versus that of an atom to give you the scale of what it looks like to zoom in. So if your atom that you you know, you have in your hand right now, if your atom were the size of a pea, the vegetable, then relatively speaking, a cell would have to be the size of one or two soccer fields. So atoms are very small. They are the smallest units of matter, and they are the chemistry that keeps everything together. So we've crossed over now to chemistry, meaning we're no longer in the alive versus dead world. So atoms aren't technically alive. They create molecules and elements and chemical reactions, but atoms, they're the source of nuclear energy. At least that's what's inside their cores. It's also called atomic energy, and this energy is always moving and vibrating and creating and destroying, so to speak. So it's always on the move, it's never still. The atom is the smallest unit of energy, but then there's also molecules and compounds and the periodic table of elements. And when I was younger, I was always confused as to what the difference was between these. So I thought I'd talk about that here in case anybody else feels the same way. First of all, the periodic table of elements, it's where it's at in chemistry. It was arranged in 1869 or so by the quote father of the periodic table, Dmitri Mendeleev, who was a Russian chemist, along with some other people. It was a long work in progress to try to understand the chaos of the universe by putting it in a neat little table. You can reference the periodic table for the list of all the elements that exist in our universe that we know of so far. There's about 118 elements that we've discovered, and they're categorized by several ways, like how many electrons or neurons or protons they each have. But each element is only made up of one atom. And the small details is what sets them apart. And so basically, element and atom are the same thing. And I think using the word element is a more accurate way to talk about the chemistry of matter, because atom just means any atom, but element can specify exactly what kind of atom we're talking about. So it's just more specific. So what happens when you take these elements that are, you know, each unique? You know, you got your hydrogen, you have carbon, oxygen, everything, you have everything there. So what happens if you mix and match some of these atoms, or what happens when they mix and match each other? So a combination of elements makes up molecules, which is two or more elements together, kind of like water. So let's take water. Water has this big oxygen molecule with two smaller hydrogen molecules attached to it. That's why it's called H2O. Technically, the scientific name is dihydrogen monoxide. Di meaning two, so dihydrogen is two hydrogens, and monoxide meaning mono is one and oxide is oxygen. So there you go. So everything is made up of elements. Every rock you see, every breath you take, and so on. And there's different kinds. Some are organic, like carbon. Some are inorganic, like metals. Those are also elements. And the periodic table really gives us a summary of all that exists by systematically grouping them into one neat chart. But not all elements are found equally on Earth or in the universe. So you might be wondering, what is the most common element on planet Earth? If you wonder about that kind of stuff, and I'll tell you, a bunch of the elements are not that common. So it's taken scientists a while to, quote, discover them, but a few are super common, and you might have already recognized that water is made up of oxygen and hydrogen. So there must be a lot of those, because there's a lot of water on Earth. So the most common elements that make up our life on Earth here are oxygen and nitrogen. And by Earth, I mean in the air, under our atmosphere, the space where humans live. But in the rest of the universe, it's different. because we have, you know, this nice little atmosphere to protect our cozy little environment where we can breathe air and have trees. But in the universe, actually, you know, deep space, the most abundant two elements are hydrogen and helium, which is mostly what stars are made out of. There are these big balls of hydrogen and helium just burning until they don't have any more left to burn. That's basically their life. So imagine our sun, which is a burning star, and some planets are also hydrogen or helium planets, which makes them gas planets. Okay, that's not like Earth, but more like Saturn and Jupiter. Planets are very large. Earth is a rock with other elements. It is not a gas planet. As you can see, the world of molecular realities can be approached from so many angles in science. And if you're getting your college degree in science, you'll likely take separate classes in the following things. 1, organic chemistry. So this is the study of things that have carbon and usually are found in living things. Or you could study inorganic chemistry, which means studying not carbon-based compounds and things like metals. Then there's physical chemistry. This is the study of how chemical systems operate. You know, they move, react based on the laws of physics. Or there's biochemistry. And this is just what it sounds like. It's biology and chemistry combined. And that's the study of where that's happening. Or there's molecular biology. And this is the molecular basis of biological activity of cells. You know, the things I talked about a lot in the beginning of this episode, because I know the most about that field. And finally, microbiology, and that's the study of the microorganisms, little guys that are really small. These separations, of course, all blend together, you know, and as a biologist or a chemist, you'd probably be familiar with all of them. But they each have a different angle at looking at this world, because we can't see this world without microscope, and it's just so mysterious and hard to learn about. And the way I learn about all this is starting with the first biology classes I had to take in college. And the way schools usually break this down for students in the beginning is they start teaching you about the microbiology first, and then they move on to bigger things like animals, and then they move on to bigger ideas in biology like ecology or the environment. In order to build those building blocks for you from the smallest matter to the biggest in biology. However, this can be very difficult for students because microbiology is just so mysterious and can be hard to imagine in your brain, since it's not something we're seeing on a daily basis compared to grass or foxes, which we see every day in Alaska. So it can just be a really abstract concept. And I don't know how you feel after this episode. I hope I made sense when I was trying to explain these things, but a lot of things need to be visualized if you're a visual person. And you know, if we can't see these things in our daily life, a lot of the science is just trying to understand, what does it look like? What does it look like for DNA to be inside a nucleus? What does it look like for a cell to have a membrane where, you know, things move in and out of the cell? And it's like, it's literally like a house with doors, and doors open and close. And, you know, the cell is very picky as to what comes in and what it lets out. And there's just a lot of this science really is like, what's happening? How is everything alive on that molecular field, in that reality? So that's the fascinating thing about molecular beings and forms and atoms. And it all blends together, of course, into one big field of science. So this week I wanted to give you some resources that are a little bit different. So I want to talk to you about some of the podcasts that I found to be really interesting about science that I listen to. And actually, a lot of the things that I know I have learned about by listening to podcasts. So first of all, the podcast called Ologies with Ali Ward is a really, really fun podcast. And it's just so diverse. It's just about the study of every episode is different study. And she interviews scientists about their expertise. And the second podcast I have here is called The Science of Everything. So if you're a really big nerd, I think you would really like that podcast. Third podcast on the list is called Big Biology. And the fourth podcast is called Big Picture Science. Podcasts are great because you can listen to them anywhere, just like this one right here you're listening to. And there's just so much information out there that's, you know, easy to learn and approachable when you just have people talk to you about it, which is what I like to do on this podcast. And second, I want to tell you guys about some magazines. Magazines are another great way to learn about stuff that's easily approachable. You know, you can have it on your dining table. You can flip through some things, learn about some stuff while you're like relaxing after dinner. But it's just like really great. And our library, the Unalaska Library, has the following magazines that I check out sometimes. So one is Popular Science. They also have Scientific American. They have, of course, the National Geographic. And then they have the magazine Wired that has science as well. Another great way to keep up with science news is some websites that focus on science news and articles about new science coming out. And some of the websites that I've gone on for this stuff are the following. ScienceNews.org is a good one. NewScientist.com is another one. If you just Google BBC Science, you'll come across that website of the BBC. And then if you're really nerdy, you could go on sciencemag.org. And that's gonna have some serious new science articles that in the scientific field, that's a big journal. Thank you guys for joining me this week on the super long episode about molecules, atoms, and other tiny biologies. And remember, check out our Facebook page on Alaska Learning Center, or give us a call at 907-581-1876 to learn more about what we do, what we have to offer in education for our community. And once again, keep your ears open and your mind open to the science in your life.